Accession number 28651, Mr. Victor Berwick, reel 3. Now, we're talking about the layout of the sort of gun position. Yeah. This is the one we're thinking of. It's at Horton Kirby, yes. The one you went to in October 1939. Now, they're in an arc. Two arcs.
Each side, yeah.
Each side. What about you? Where would you be? How far away would the gun the command post?
The command post would be roughly... not more than 50 yards, about 25 yards from the actual the guns, in the centre, so to speak, of the arc. Yeah, about 25 yards, and that would be surrounded by sandbags.
Was there one predictor for each section then?
One predictor for the troop serving the four guns.
So the two predictors to the battery.
Yeah, they each had identical information from the predictor. Yeah.
Now, where would the rest of the command post be? Would they be in the same sort of
right in the centre, which was, as I say, sandbagged round with an entry point.
Now, what was your daily routine when you set up at
We had normal reveille, or reveille, if you want the French pronunciation. of course, we had parade. I assume that we're quiescent at the time, no alerts or anything at all. And so we would have reveille, and you would get shaved and dressed, and... you would have a morning parade with your mess tin, and then you would go and get breakfast. And then you
would... Now, can we ask about, while we're doing it, what was the food like, for you? Used to home food and the rest of it, what did you think of the food?
It was adequate, but the cooks were... we did eventually get cooks from the catering corps. But initially, I think that the cooks were just, they had a slight cooking experience and were appointed to the job. And of course, there were lots of cook's assistants who did all the cleaning up and so forth. The cook didn't do the job just himself. He had a little team.
So what exactly would you get, say, for breakfast?
I really forget.
But it wasn't too bad.
Oh, no, it was adequate.
So what next then? You have breakfast.
Yeah, then next it would be to what they call examine equipment.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, you had two teams. You see, each troop had a duty team and a standby team. So the duty team was day on, day off. Would report to the guns. Each gun team would go to the gun, and the predictor team and the command post team would report there. And you would go through a certain routine of checking the equipment, and that was making sure that the bores were in good condition. The bores would be cleaned out with a long PS Arbor. It was a special brush on a long pole, and would be cleaned out. The breech would be dismantled, oiled, and all the dials and the other equipment we checked between the predictor and the guns. The predictor would also go through a certain drill as well, make sure that was functioning properly. Battery was also tested. We had a hydrometer to test the state of the battery. Of course, that had to be standby batteries. Of course, that was a vital part of the equipment.
And was there anything that was on your predictor that was a cause of concern? In other words, was there something that reliably broke down?
No. I can't remember any breakdown on the predictor.
So basically it was a solid, reliable piece of
Absolutely.
Kit?
Absolutely. It was very heavy.
So the morning you'd be doing this, checking equipment. What next?
We did a certain amount of PT.
Now, how much PT?
Might be half an hour, not more. Route marches, when we were Horton Kirby, the war hadn't been declared, I don't think, then. Of course, I remember taking one squad on a route march. But it's a bit difficult. We filled in our days in the early part of the war. Of course, the rest of the time we were...
What about in the afternoon? Not sure?
I can't really remember, I don't think. Not to.
Was there a night duty roster? I mean, would some people be on at night?
Every night there would be a night team on. That would be on purely on the command post. And you also have a guard team. There will be a daily guard duty. Because even though you're in a safe area, one had to be quite sure there'd be no sabotage from any outside source. So there were always people on guard around the guns.
And would that include you? I mean, were you put on guard?
I would be possibly part of the guard.
What was it like on guard?
Normally, the guard duty was given to one of the junior sort of non-commissioned officers. Like as a bombardier, for instance, or only a lance bombardier might be put in charge of a guard team who would comprise on the position of whereabouts. It might be a team of six guard, and or might be more. But you would have the on and off, do so many a stint of so many hours on, so many hours off. But the NCO in charge had to be on the key vive the whole time, pretty well. Because he arranged the roster who was next on, and he would position them in the required points. And also the duty officer of the day would also make it his duty to inspect the guard at some unknown time, and always make sure that not the same time, and make sure everybody wasn't going to sleep on the job.
Was it difficult to stay awake?
Not really, except that I must admit that when things were quiet, I remember on one occasion we had two ex-army people, old soldiers. One chap called Pierce, who eventually finished up as a Chelsea pensioner, I remember, lived at Kennington over here, and another fellow. And they said, "Go on, Bobby, put your head down, have a sleep. And we said, we'll wait you if anything happens." So... I'm not sure whether I did fall asleep, but I probably did.
And what about command post night duty? I mean, nothing happened, I presume.
Well, you see, just to fill you in there, the command post wasn't isolated. It had a connection, a telephone connection, with the gun operations room, which in our case would be, when we were in Horton Kirby, it was at Chatham. The GOR, the Gun Operations Room, was at Chatham. When we were down at Dover and Manson, it was at Dover. That was a landline, telephone connection. And directly any information came through that was possibility of a raid, all gun positions would be alerted, and the gun teams called out. We had klaxons which sounded the alarm, and so everybody just took post. That's the term, you took post.
But I presume this didn't happen much in the Vicarsville.
No, I'll come on to my first sort of action.
Now, what about recreations while you were there? I mean, were you allowed out to Dartford?
We used to get evening leave. The off-duty section got evening leave. We used to go dances and so forth.
Whereabouts?
A place called Darenth, which was the next village. Darenth.
Darenth.
Yeah. No, it was Sutton at Hone. Sutton at Hone was the next village to Horton Kirby. SUTTON. Sutton at Hone, HONE. But there was a club there where we used to go and spend an evening.
And what were these dances like? Because... things have all changed. What was a dance, village dance
the locals
like?
Used to be there. You dance with local girls and so forth.
And was it live music or
it was live music. Oh, yes. It was live music, yeah.
Did you drink? Would you go to pubs?
Oh, yeah, yes, go to the local pubs, and also you get drink at the dances. Oh, yes, we used to enjoy life best we could.
Did you like a drink, or were you just a moderate drinker?
No, I was a moderate drinker, yeah.
Now, what's the next thing you're... So you went there in October.
Next thing I think I ought to mention is that when we were at Horton Kirby, I think I've been promoted to full bombardier, you know, two stripes.
Now, what difference did it make being promoted? First a lance bombardier and then bombardier. Does it make a difference?
Well, yes, you had more responsibility. I was detached from the battery to take command of a Lewis gun site.
Now that's in January 1940.
January, yeah.
So you'd been at Horton. Essentially, nothing much happened at Horton. It was just two or three months of.
Still at Horton Kirby.
Okay, so what happened when what were you going to do?
Well, we had. There were two Lewis gun sites also as protection against Vickers Armstrong. But for low-flying aircraft, if you see, our guns were not suited for low-flying aircraft because of, A, they couldn't travel as quickly, but with a low-flying aircraft coming great speed, you've got to be able to get the gun moving quickly, but which wasn't possible. So I was detached to a Lewis gun site, four Lewis guns, which fired the ordinary 303 rifle bullet, but it was a reasonably quick-firing gun, and it had an ammunition magazine of, I think, 40 rounds, not more, of 303. And they were what they called a pan. They were a circular thing which clamped on top of the Lewis gun. And we had two of these sites, one on the east side and one on the west of the...
And you were in charge of one of those?
On the east side, yeah.
And that was at Waterworks Lane, in Dartford.
Yes.
And guarding the same Vickers works
against low-flying aircraft. And I had built in a little hut near the actual gun position. I had a cook, and I think I had eight men. Of course, it had to be, it might have been six men. Yes, I think probably six, plus the cook and myself. And the six men would be one on each gun, and two to make sure there were plenty of pans of ammunition available if one was in action. And of course, you're getting through a pan in quite a quick time. So that was my first command, you see. But also, I think at that site, witnessed, I think, was probably one of the first disasters from a friendly fire. It happened early one morning, or early-ish, daybreak, or before breakfast, I'm pretty sure. Very cold, it's in January, very cold, frosty morning, a lot of hoarfrost, and we were called out by the operation room, because they had a telephone communication with the GOR, that there was an unidentified enemy aircraft in the vicinity. And so we duly got onto the guns and had, we issued with leather jerkins to keep the cold out, which were very good actually, and mittens, and we were hanging around. Suddenly I heard sounds of an aircraft in the clouds above us, and you've got that, have you?
Yep, it's just the press report. Carry on.
I'm repeating what I said.
No, remember, they can't see that. So.
No. Out of the cloud, I suddenly saw this aircraft going away from us to the east, which I identified as a friendly plane, because it was a Lockheed Hudson, which easily identified, but it had a rather unusual tail formation. In those days, were twin tail and twin fin, twin rudders and twin fins. And then following it out of the clouds came two hurricanes, which spread to one side and then came in and opened fire on it from each side. And the plane, each plane would carry identification signals, and we were also issued with the same information, which changed every day, that the identification for friendly against foe was by a certain code of flares. Three flares would come out, and the plane ejected the three flares for the day, which indicated it was friendly, but it was too late, the hurricanes had hit it, and it started to smoke, and it crash-landed in the woods at Mepham in North Kent. But I reported the incident straight away to the operations room, and they told me to keep quiet about it in certain terms like that. But it did come to my knowledge a little later via the battery that the crew of that particular aircraft were dressed in German uniforms. Now, that's not mentioned there, I don't think. Which made me rather wonder, was it a nefarious operation by us going on the other side on some mission? But following that, the article, it did call for another letter from a chap who actually, I think, lives at Chatham, Charing, just up the road here. He was in the medical hall, RAMC, based in Dartford area, and he was sent as part of a team to the crash site to see whether they could render any first aid there, but they weren't allowed access. The police were there, and even the army were not allowed to go near it. And he had the same story, that the crew were dressed in German uniforms. So there we are.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Now, anything else you recall happening while you were at in this, Waterworks Lane?
No, that was all.
Did you ever go into action? I mean, was there ever an attack?
No.
So it's just a period. I should have asked a bit more. What was the accommodation like?
It was just a hut.
What was it like in there? I mean,
we slept on the floor with
all of you in the same hut.
Oh yes, and the cooking was done in the same hut, one end.
And what about beds and heating? It's January, February. It's supposed to be colder.
I know. We had palliasses to sleep on. That's a straw-filled mattress.
On the floor?
On the floor.
And any heating?
And it was very cold.
No stove?
No. When you always had to make your bed when you rose. The army being the army, and fold your blankets in a certain way, and you had a ground sheet under your palliasse. I remember that it was so cold there that the heat from your body caused condensation on the ground sheet, that the ground sheet literally were frozen to the floor. You had to rip them off and fold it up. We had no form of heating there.
Now, what about this business about them being issued with pikes?
That's a bit later.
A bit later, right. So what's the next thing that happens? The Waterworks Lane, that was still...
Yes, well, then eventually the battery was moved to Chatham.
Now, did you then leave Waterworks Lane and go with them to Chatham?
Oh, yes. I was part of the battery, you see. So we all moved away.
Now, that was, according to this, in... February 1940.
Yes, we went to actually the gun position was at Iwade.
That's near Sittingbourne, is it?
Well, actually, it's right by the King's Ferry Bridge, the entry onto the Isle of Sheppey, with a new bridge being built to take the road traffic, as you probably know.
Now, you were there covering Chatham Dockyard.
That's right, on the east side, and there were other guns all around Chatham, because it's a very vital point.
And what was this base like? I mean, if it was laid out in the same fashion?
But with 4.5 guns.
Now, what was the... Had you left your other guns behind?
Oh, yes, they were left in situ, and we took over... See, the 4.5s were static. You couldn't move them.
And were they anti-aircraft guns?
Yes. They're purpose-built.
What were they like, again, compared to the 3.7?
Totally different. They had a very much bigger round, called 4.5 or 3.7, so you gather the difference. It was four, Seinagal ran a much bigger cartridge, so they were about half hundredweight each round.
And much heavier.
Much heavier, yeah. And also they could only be loaded onto the guns by means of a special launching screw of different. You know what I mean by a diabolo? No.
Don't worry, they might.
It's like a reel that caved into it, goes in. There was always a toy called diabolo. You sat on strings and you would do like that, and it's two cones wanted to a central point, right? Well, they had that sort of that set up there, and the round would be the man carried push on there. He push on the base. You go up there, and there'd be two men on the loading tray who grab the round and drop it on the loading tray, which was then automatically moved over by a big electric motor to bring it into line with the breech, and then. It would be fired, the actual mechanism would, not done by hand now, all done by electric rammer on a big reel, which rammed the round home, not a man pushing it, too heavy.
Were they a good gun? How did they compare?
Yes, they had a good ceiling, over 30,000 feet.
Reasonably modern.
But much better from the gunner's point of view, because they were fully protective. Both each layer, the gun was encased by a huge shield right the way around, so that the muzzle, the actual the barrel of the gun pointed out through this shield, but the actual layers of two guns had no outside contact. With the 3.7, everything's open. I'm saying you could fire them over open sights against low-flying aircraft, possibly, or if anything broke down, they could be used. But with 4.5, there's this huge casing completely shielded both of the gun layers and a lot of the gun crew working behind, which was an asset.
So if anything went wrong, they were useless, but if they went right, they were safer.
Oh, yeah, quite.
Now, your predictor, still the clockwork,
still the
Vickers.
Yeah.
Anything changing? I mean, we've got, you know, 6 months into the war now. Was any improvements brought in the predictor, or would it stay the same?
No. We had to learn the new drill, of course, on the 4.5.
Was that different much? I mean,
well, only from the loading angle, mainly.
But the data from the predictor went down.
Everything was identical. One thing I haven't mentioned is fuse setting.
Well, tell me about that.
Yeah. It's a rather vital point, of course, because you've got to have the right fuse for the right height in the aircraft.
This would mean the fuse is what detonate at a specific height.
At a certain time in flight. And... that was done by means of the fuse setter. Each gun had a fuse setter attached to it. And before the actual round could be loaded into the gun, it had to go through the fuse setter. And the number four on the gun, he was the auto-operating dial, similar to the gun layers, with the information sent by the predictor as to the right fuse setting. And so the round was jammed into the actual fuse setter, and the fuse setter just pulled a lever, which meant that it were the interlocking pins on the setter, which fastened onto little slots on the fuse ring. You see, it was a powder fuse, and directly the gun is fired, that released a pellet in the fuse through sort of inertia, which spark the fuse into life, the what's called a detonator, and so the fuse started to burn, and it would only burn so far as it came to a halt, and that halting position was done by the fuse setter, and And from that holding position, there was an axis onto the explosive. And that detonated the round at the right time. Very vital part of the equipment.
Now, anything happening at Iwade?
Yes. Identification parade by a pregnant woman.
Tell me about that.
Yes. We were out on the marshes at Iwade, real bird sanctuary. You know, of course, it's tidal, that area, and all the gullyways and so forth in these marshes fill up. We used to go bird watching. But anyway, we were all assembled on parade on one occasion for an identification parade. And it was by a young girl in charge of a lady and the CO, one of the officers, and we were all lined up and inspected by this young girl because she was pregnant by somebody from troops in the area. And I don't think anybody from our battery was, at least from our troop, I don't know where the other was the guilty person, I don't know.
I should have asked, which troop were you?
I was in A troop.
I should have asked.
Yes, I was in A troop with 29.
Now, anything else happened there? No raids.
We had one or two nighttime alerts, but
false alarms. Or
yeah, yes.
Tell me, what would a false alarm be like?
Well, we'd be called out by the command post, by the gunner operations room, that's the possibility of aircraft going to the area. Because you got the radar station at just behind Dover, and the other one at Boughton near Faversham, and they would give fairly early warning, and usually these definitely all time were at Chatham, the false alarms were never went into action at all at that point. But we had several calls out where. Planes, we have heard planes above, but never given any permission to engage at all.
Now, anything else happening?
No, not there.
Would you go to Chatham from there?
No, we used to go into Iwade for our evenings off, and we got the weekend leave, Ashford being so close. And
so what was it like going back to Ashford on weekend leave?
Oh, it was really pleasant.
What would you do?
Well, it was only a very brief period.
Would you? I mean, would you go and see your work colleagues on Saturday morning?
No,
or?
No. I don't. I can't remember ever going into the office to say hello. I think I completely divorced from it. They managed to cope.
So it's mainly just going to see the wife and.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Now, so what's the next thing that happens then? You seem to be there about 2 months till April.
Yeah, not very long, and then we rejoined the regiment at Dover.
That was a detached.
We'd been on detachment from the word go. We hadn't been.
Was it the troop? The troop was detached, or the battery?
The battery, the two troops. Yeah.
Now, so you went to Dover, and yeah. That's where the whole of the rest of the there'd be one other battery was there, or two batteries.
The whole of the battery was there. We initially were, my troop was at Guston, which was quite near the radar station.
Guston?
Guston, Guston, near the radar station.
Is that what you were covering?
We were there to cover Dover, the port installation, and also the radar station, which is very vital. A vital part of our defence system, but we're just across the road from the Duke of York School, which is still going strong. It's a very, very well-known military school. I think the people who have got a military background go there. It's a sort of public school, and we often used to go across and have the use of their swimming pool, which was very, very nice, very handy.
And what was happening there? What guns were you? Did you have there?
Yeah, 3-inch still the original 3-inch.
So the no, you didn't have any other guns to take over,
or no.
So So this must have, the 3-inch must have seen a come down after the 3.7 and the 4.
Oh, absolutely. And also remember the first plane we engaged was a friendly one, but luckily we didn't hit it.
Now tell me the story of that.
Well, we were on alert, and the plane came over, and it had unusual markings. And one wing was painted black, and one was painted white on the underside. It was a fair height, but I wasn't on duty at the time. I didn't recognise it at all, but it looked a bit like a hurricane, you know, from the wing shape. Anyway, the officer in charge of the on-duty section decided to open fire. So they fired four rounds, that is one round for each gun at it. Luckily, I was working on a rather false height, I think, and luckily missed it, but it turned out to be a hurricane.
Was there any comeback over that?
I don't know. I was only a ranker at the time. I'd been promoted to sergeant